You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Al-Qaeda carried out the attacks on 9/11, they had around 400 members. Today, have many thousands of supporters. Former FBI Special Agent Ali Sufan writes, the cancer of bin Ladenism has metastasized across the Middle East and North Africa and beyond. In his latest book, Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State, he draws upon his years analyzing Al-Qaeda and related groups to delve into the psychology of terrorists. It's published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ali Sufan to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
You were at home assembling a swing for your twin boys when President Obama announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed. What was your first reaction?
Wow. It was such a weird feeling. I mean, I was happy to hear that that terror mastermind was finally dead. I thought about many of the friends that I lost along the way. I thought about what happened on 9/11, kind of like my life played like a flash. But also at the same time, I was very concerned because I thought that Bin Laden dead can be more effective and influential
as a martyr.
As a martyr, than he's alive. If we don't target the ideology and the incubating factors that feeds into his narrative, and
we've kind of seen that in the years since, because we keep on killing the heads of these various groups, and yet they continue to thrive. Somebody else just takes their place.
Immediately after Bin Laden's death, I think somebody from the New York Times contacted me and said if I can write an op-ed about his death. And I kind of mentioned exactly that we need to be very careful not to think that by killing Bin Laden, we killed the threat of terrorism. And there's a big possibility that his movement will separate into different movements. And we've seen that with ISIS. Ayman Zawahiri haven't been able, the current leader of Al-Qaeda, haven't been able to keep Al-Qaeda unified under the banner of bin Ladenism.
Well, we kill the messenger, but not the message. But what parts of bin Laden's message still resonate with so many? Because ISIS isn't the same thing as Al-Qaeda.
It's not, but in the same time, ISIS used to be Al-Qaeda's branch in Iraq, and they had a lot of differences on how to rule the area that they are controlling and how to conduct terrorism. ISIS, at the leadership of Zarqawi, believed that killing other Muslims can be a priority than killing Americans, for example, people who don't believe in them.
Doesn't the Quran forbid the killing of other Muslims? Is it because they only kill Shiites?
Well, the Quran forbids, a lot of things that Al-Qaeda does. I mean, they didn't kill only Shia for Iraq, even though Zarqawi would like his followers to believe that's what they focused on. In Al-Anbar province alone, which is the largest Sunni province in Iraq, they killed more than 250 Sunni scholars. They were trying to evacuate the Sunni area from any legitimate religious authority so they can control these communities. So they did a lot of things. I mean, a lot of the issues that bin Laden talked about or a lot of the issues that Zarqawi did or advocated has nothing to do with the religion in so many different ways, even though they believe it's rooted in some ideological and religious roots.
How much control did bin Laden have over some of the regional groups like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, a lot of us thought when bin Laden was hiding, he is basically just trying to stay alive and he has no control over the organization. However, we now know that he was actually micromanaging these organizations. The only one that he had a problem in controlling was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And many of his operatives that he sent to assist and help Zarqawi were complaining about about what Zarqawi was doing in Iraq, to the point that bin Laden and Zawahiri had to establish a committee inside al-Qaeda to deal with this rogue affiliate in Iraq. Unfortunately, they did not do anything about it. And many of their members and supporters in Iraq told them that they are responsible now, you know, in front of God and the hereafter of what Zarqawi and what al-Qaeda in Iraq doing under their name. But he was in total control. And
you say that, in fact, he was uniquely qualified to lead al-Qaeda and maintain control over the regional groups in ways that his successor, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has not been.
Sure. Ayman al-Zawahiri does not have the story that bin Laden had.
Well, he's an Egyptian. Does that cause some suspicion?
That has something to do with it. You know, bin Laden was from Saudi Arabia. He was from the Gulf. He is a son of a billionaire who left the life of, you know, Saudi princess, basically, in order to lead the life of jihad. He had the credibility. He had the charisma. Zawahiri did not have any of these things. And many Qaeda members and many Qaeda leaders viewed Zawahiri as a freeloader, as a person who failed in the Egyptian Islamic Jihad movement and used bin Laden and used al-Qaeda in order to basically find a new jihadi life for himself.
Well, you, in your first book, The Black Banners, the Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against al-Qaeda, you told the story of the rise of al-Qaeda. But as I understood it at the time, Zawahiri, that he actually was the ideological brains behind the creation of al-Qaeda.
You know, the ideological brain behind...
I mean, he brought the Islamic Brotherhood's ideas to bin Laden.
Not really, because Ayman Zawahiri was close to bin Laden, you know, at one point, and he met bin Laden early on in Peshawar during the Soviet jihad. But bin Laden was really impacted by people like Abdullah Azzam, for example. And Ayman al-Zawahiri gave bin Laden something bin Laden did not have. He gave him a lot of top-notch operatives who are Egyptians to be around him, to protect him, to help build his network. However, he continued to be the head of his own organization, the Egyptian Islamic Jihad Group, until just before 9/11, May of 2001, when the two organizations joined together, and part of the agreement of the unification of the two groups, that Zawahiri will be the number two of al-Qaeda, something that angered many people who have been with bin Laden from the beginning, to include some Egyptians who were introduced to him by Ayman Zawahiri.
My guest is Ali Soufan, who was a counterterrorism expert in the FBI. He's written a number of books about al-Qaeda and what has followed. His latest, Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. And you write that Syria's al-Qaeda branch has more members than bin Laden had in his entire network when he was at his height. Does that include al-Qaeda's... are you including the Islamic State as
No, I'm not even adding the Islamic State to that. I'm just adding al-Nusra, or Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, as it's called now. That alone is about 20,000 members. 20,000 members. Remember, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, bin Laden on the eve of 9/11 had only about 400 members. So you can imagine how al-Qaeda, you can imagine how the ideas of Osama bin Laden spreading all over the Middle East. Al-Shabaab has more than 7,000. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb was finally able to unify all the different branches, regardless to tribal and ethnic affiliation, under one group. Al-Qaeda in Yemen, just since the Saudi war in Yemen, went from less than 1,000 to more than 5,000. This is where al-Qaeda is today.
Do the various terrorist groups, the ones in Somalia, the ones in Nigeria, the ones in Iraq and Syria, do they all have any connections to each other, or are they operate as separate units?
Well, it depends. Like, for example, al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, al-Shabaab, they are affiliated with al-Qaeda Central. They still take some kind of the general strategy. The day-to-day operation is led by the local commanders. I mean, bin Laden thinks of the new al-Qaeda after 9/11 with its affiliates as kind of like, you know, for the lack of a better term, the McDonald, you know, theory. You know, you can operate your own local branch the way that you want as long as you have the brand things to consider, you know, the overall strategy. Nigeria is a totally different situation. Boko Haram tried to join Al-Qaeda a few times, but Al-Qaeda did not accept them. So they finally joined ISIS when ISIS came out. And there's many reasons why Al-Qaeda did not allow Boko Haram in. And frankly, some of it has to do with racism. You know, ISIS was able to take anyone who wanted to join them. But most of the other affiliates that have been in existence for more than a decade, those affiliates, you know, locally they do their own things, but however they operate under the umbrella and the strategy of Al-Qaeda Central.
And they only want Arabs.
Well, they take other people who are not Arabs, but they are picky in who they accept. And the biggest proof about that is Boko Haram in Nigeria, for example.
Which is all black.
Yeah. But they take non-Arabs in Africa. And Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, for example, they have Tawareg, they have Berber, they have Fulanis who are Africans.
Hasn't the Islamic State even tried to expand into Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda has had a long relationship with the Taliban?
Sure, they've been able actually to have a branch, Wilayat Khorasan, the province of Khorasan. They did a few terrorist attacks both on the Pakistani side and on the Afghani side, but I don't think they have the ability to seriously challenge the Taliban in Afghanistan.
On the other hand, they have become really international. They've engaged in mass murder in Paris and airports in Brussels and Istanbul,
sure.
A Russian airliner over Sinai, a Christian market in Berlin. They've killed police soldiers and border guards in Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. We list a lot of the attacks that they conducted just to show the international reach and how the Islamic State or the so-called Islamic State shifted from establishing a state, and their motto at the time, Baqiya wa Tatamaddad, remaining and expanding. They didn't want to do terrorism outside their areas. They just wanted to control their areas. They were trying to create this kind of like utopia and convince people to come over and join them in the so-called caliphate. But in the same time, when they were under pressure, they did exactly what they attacked Al-Qaeda of doing. They started to do terrorist attacks outside and trying to create havoc, especially in Western states, in order to relieve the pressure in Iraq and in Syria.
Now, Al-Qaeda carried out a number of attacks throughout Europe, but only 9/11 here in the United States. Why do you think there weren't more from Al-Qaeda in the United States?
Well, it's not for the lack of trying. I think we have to give credit for our intelligence and law enforcement services here in the United States. They've been doing a great job, in disrupting a plot and stopping a plot. Every now and then something happens, but to the most part, we have a new kind of threat matrix where people can self-radicalize themselves on, you know, watching YouTube videos or going online. And
they don't have to go to training.
They don't have to go to training. They don't have to travel. They don't have to get instructions from overseas. And sometimes just you go from the radicalization phase to the mobilization phase overnight. But even with that, I think our law enforcement and intelligence services has been very good in disrupting. After the Arab Spring, I think the Arab Spring changed a lot of the calculus of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda decided to focus locally rather than doing terrorist attacks in the West.
And we have to take a little break. We'll come back to the Arab Spring and other issues with Ali Soufan, whose latest book is Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. It is published by Norton. Stay with us for more. We're back with Ali Soufan. His latest book, Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State, published by Norton. 14 years after 9/11, the United States hit the largest Al-Qaeda training base in Afghanistan. What was the outcome?
It was one of the largest Qaeda bases we ever found. It goes miles and miles. That gives you an idea that Al-Qaeda was still there. They were training. They were, fighting in Afghanistan. We thought we kicked them out of Afghanistan. We thought we destroyed the Taliban, but we have been in Afghanistan. This is our longest war, more than World War I and World War II combined.
And Afghanistan keeps on going back and forth. There are
sure.
some provinces that will probably always be controlled by the Taliban.
Sure. See, the problem is we depend only on the military. We have the best military in the world. They do a fantastic job. We have very weak diplomatic efforts. We have weak vision of Afghanistan. So the military's job is to secure a country, to secure the area, and to allow the diplomats and the politicians to come up with a solution. We haven't been doing that. We're only using one tool, the military tool and the intelligence tool, and that's not enough to win a war.
Have you seen the film War Machine, which is based on what happened with Stanley McChrystal when he came to Afghanistan and said, well, I'll clean this whole thing up?
Yeah, it's very difficult to clean issues that have to do with history. It has to do with culture. It has to do with tribalism. It has to do with economy. It has to do with so many different components to the fact to the components that's creating the chaos in Afghanistan, to include geopolitics, to include Iran and India and Pakistan and Russia. Everyone has an interest over there.
And you get the feeling that a lot of the people who live in these areas really don't take sides. They just feel like they're victims. Whoever comes in there, they're not any happier to see the Americans than they are to see the Taliban.
No one. I mean, I traveled around the world and I worked in many conflict zones, and no one like an occupying force. No one like to see foreigners on their own lands. We don't like it here in America, and nobody else is going to like it anywhere around the world. And this is one of the problems when you have the military staying for a long period of time and we don't have any political solution in sight. We have a diplomatic failure in kind of generating the environment to move forward in Afghanistan and in any other places. We've seen that in Iraq too. You know, eventually people are going to start turning against you.
Didn't the upheaval of the Arab Spring allow many jihadists to return to their home countries?
Yeah, and that was an order from Osama bin Laden himself. Osama bin Laden was watching the Arab Spring unfolding in his hideouts, and then he wrote a letter to his chief of staff.
Can I quote from it?
Yeah, sure.
It's a little long, but I think it's fascinating. It reveals just how smart he was, actually. He said, "Do not present a prominent figurehead because he, too, can easily be killed or co-opted. Do not be squeamish about bloodletting because it is an inevitable part of the liberation struggle. Do not cast the security forces as the first enemy of the people because they can be turned into the path of God. Above all, do not be tempted to compromise with the ruler, even if it means less bloodshed in the short term."
Absolutely. And this is exactly what you see Al-Qaeda doing in places like Yemen and places like Syria, people who actually listen still to Al-Qaeda Central. But another thing that bin Laden mentioned in that letter to his chief of staff, a Libyan by the name of Mahmoud, he goes also by many different aliases to include Atiyah al-Libi. And Atiyah or
Why Mahmoud, so many different names?
Well, they have many different aliases in order to kind of like hide their identity. It was so funny at one point that bin Laden told his chief of staff, stop giving me all these different aliases for people who change their name. Go back to the original name because I have no idea who you're talking about. So bin Laden was confused with the different aliases that Mahmoud was telling him at one point when they were trying to select new leaders and new commanders. But I think one thing that bin Laden realized that the Arab Spring changed the whole calculus of Al-Qaeda. He realized that at one point, he was telling his commanders, focus only on the West, focus only on the United States, don't do attacks here and there because you need to basically cut the head of the snake, hit the head of the snake. With the Arab Spring, when he starts seeing all these leaders collapsing, he realized that now he needs to focus locally, not globally. And he told his commanders, anyone from who can go back to their own country of origin. You can go back to Libya or to Egypt or to Tunisia. Go ahead and do it. Leave Afghanistan. We already broke the cross, meaning us, meaning the United States, in Afghanistan. And let's go and now defeat them in these areas. Let's create a vacuum and be sure that no one can fill that vacuum but us. And if that means we have to kill a lot of Muslims, let it be. And he continued, we have to kill them to save them. We have to kill them to save them. And Al-Qaeda suddenly changed. Now they are not focusing on doing attacks in New York, in Washington, in Madrid, in London, in Belgium. Now they start focusing to build to building armies, to building a movement in Yemen, in Syria, in Libya, and in Tunisia and other places.
And you looked at correspondence between Mahmoud and Osama bin Laden about the Arab Spring. Had bin Laden been surprised by it?
Yeah, I think he was. And he actually, in one of the letters, told his commanders through Mahmoud, he said, this is the very first time we've seen this since the time of Saladin, you know, since the times of the Crusade. This is once in a lifetime opportunity, once in a century opportunity. And that indicates to him, to, you know, bin Laden was talking about himself, that indicates to me that the blessed attacks, what he called the blessed attacks on 9/11, are paying off. Now America is so scared to come to the Middle East and to save its tyrants.
He also noticed through the tranche of diplomatic cables that WikiLeaks released that there was a lot of corruption in the leadership in the Arab world. Do we know if bin Laden was thinking about changing the mission of al-Qaeda to include unseating some of the corrupt leaders within the Arab world?
Well, his goal was to unseat the leaders from the beginning. He differs with people like Zarqawi when they have some commanders on al-Qaeda who wanted to basically hit the leaders and then hit the United States. He wanted to hit the United States because he thought if the United States collapsed, then all these leaders would collapse. So his
goal, thought he could actually bring down the United States government?
He thought that if we weaken the United States enough to make the United States fearful to get engaged in the Middle East, fearful economically, fearful politically, fearful militarily, then these regimes will fall. And he thought of the Arab Spring that his strategy was a success.
And which regimes did he want to fall?
All
was
of
he
them. Going,
Saudi Arabia,
all
his home country?
Absolutely. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, all the different regimes in the Middle East. He wanted to establish an Islamic caliphate, a state.
Which the ISIS has finally done, despite the fact that they are kind of at war with Al-Qaeda.
Well, they did, but the way they did it was totally opposite of what bin Laden said to Zarqawi and to his commanders in Yemen and his commanders in Somalia. Do not establish a state, because the moment you establish a state, the West and the United States are going to come and destroy you. So what you need to do is you have to go through different stages. Stage one, you create chaos. Stage two, you fill that chaos and don't allow anyone else to fill it except you, and build coalitions and present yourself as appropriate rulers. Stage three, you build a state. ISIS started with a state. They didn't go through the three stages. Al-Qaeda is now between stage one and stage two. It depends what country you're talking about.
I'm speaking with Ali Soufan. His latest book, Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. It is published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many of the people we've been talking about are dead now.
Yeah.
Zarqawi, Mahmoud was killed in a drone strike just 6 months after bin Laden was killed. In your introduction, you say that empathy is of crucial importance for Americans in their fight against terrorism. How would empathy help us fight terrorism?
Well, many of the people we talked about are dead, but many of the original commanders who helped start al-Qaeda with Osama bin Laden are still alive. right?
So, do we know their names?
Yeah, well, Saif al-Adl, for example, the head of the security of al-Qaeda, Abu Muhammad al-Masri, who was the mastermind of the twin bombings in East Africa and in charge of all al-Qaeda training. And the list go. Abu Khair al-Masri, for example, one of the top leaders of the Shura Council, he was just killed, actually, not long time ago in Syria, out of all places. And he was the number two of the organization. Anwar Ayman Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda, and so forth. So it's important to understand, you know, when I talk about, you know, first of all, I don't want to confuse empathy with sympathy. Every time we have a terrorist attack, every time we do something wrong, we say we did not imagine, we could not imagine, we could not imagine planes flying into the World Trade Center into building. We cannot imagine it will take more troops in Iraq to secure Iraq rather than taking Saddam down. So what we need to do is basically we need to understand where the enemy is coming from. We need to understand our enemy on a personal level. Well, we need to understand what makes them tick. We need to understand what's the incubating factors that feeds into the ideology and their narrative, how they are able to recruit, how they are able to basically convince people to blow themselves up. Only when we understand these things on a personal level, only we know our enemy in such a deep way, we will be able to defeat the enemy. It's the saying of Sun Tzu. You know, if you know your enemy and know yourself, you will win 100 times in 100 battles. Unfortunately, during this so-called war on terrorism, we forget who we are, and we did not take time to learn about our enemy.
And I seem to remember that at the time of 9/11, there were very few Arabic speakers in U.S. intelligence.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that have been important even before 9/11?
It is. And you know what? We had a lot of people after 9/11 who know al-Qaeda inside out. Maybe they didn't speak Arabic, but they were very familiar of the organization and have been tracking the organization from the beginning. But unfortunately, it became a political issue at the time. And our retaliation against al-Qaeda in 9/11 went to Iraq, in heaven's sake, a country that had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. And Iraq opens a Pandora's box, and we've seen the evil of that Pandora's box that's spreading all over the world today that came out of what happened in Iraq, of the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
And it's been pointed out, in fact, just the other day in the New York Times, that the winner of that war actually winds up being Iran.
Absolutely. And we see now Iran expanding its influence all over the Middle East. Qasem Soleimani, the head of Al-Quds Force, who's also a character in the book, can actually drive his car now all the way from Tehran to southern Lebanon, and he will drive in areas and in regions and in countries all controlled by militias on his payroll.
So this is back to the Ottoman Empire.
Without
Turkey being
I think the Syrian war exposed the nature of the conflict that we're living today. I mean, you see Sunni fighting Shia, Turks fighting Kurds, Kurds fighting Turks, Arab fighting Persians. You know, it's basically what you see in Syria today is war between czars and sultans and so-called caliphs. We're talking about the 16th century here.
How are relations with potential allies in Europe and elsewhere affecting our capacity to address possible terrorist threats?
I think when it comes to terrorism, when it comes to the relationships between the FBI and the CIA and the Pentagon and other intelligence and military services in the UK, I think things are going really good. I don't think that will be impacted by any tweets from, you know, presidents or anything else.
You also note that the Paris attack that killed over 130 people was conducted by just 9 men. In England, cars are being used randomly against pedestrians. So how can we prevent these attacks when they can happen anywhere and any time? I wonder just how much we know about every time there is one of these attacks, we read, we were aware of their potential dangers, but then they wound up being able to do this anyway.
Yeah, I think the threat matrix is very different today than it used to be before. And, you know, especially that a lot of the things that we have in place, like figure out travel pattern, communications, connections with other members of, terrorist cells or suspected individuals, all these things are not really in place right now, and that's creating a black hole in our security system and in our surveillance system where people can do this.
How effective have we been on cracking down on recruitment in Europe and the United States recently?
Well, I think Europe is very different than the United States. I think we're good in the United States, believe it or not. I mean, if you look at the foreign fighter numbers, for example, as an indicator of the popularity of that narrative and that ideology. In the United States, we have about 3 to 4 million Muslims. We had about 150 people who went to Iraq and Syria, joined the jihad.
Mostly from
in
Minneapolis.
Iraq and Syria. No, not necessarily. You know, we have them from all over. We have them from Mississippi and Alabama and New York City. We have them all over the place. There's not basically one specific stereotype for it. But also at the same time, in Europe, the situation is very different. Belgium alone, that have 500,000 Muslims, have more than 500 people who went to join the conflict zone in Iraq and Syria. So there are many different issues in Europe that has to do with assimilation, that has to do with the feeling of communities that they belong or they don't belong, which that does not exist as much here.
We've been better at assimilating.
Absolutely.
But in your view, how is the proposed Muslim ban been effective? Has it made it easier for ISIS and Al-Qaeda to recruit potential terrorists?
Well, they will try to take advantage of it. And some of them, their publications already tried to take advantage of it. But also at the same time, I think people in the Muslim world see that when the president announced a Muslim ban, you have thousands of people went and surrounded airports in the United States in cold weather in order to say this is illegal. So that is also something that the world is watching. And those people who went and challenged on the streets, at airports, in the courtrooms, the Muslim bans contribute to our war against groups like Al-Qaeda and groups like ISIS.
In just a few minutes that we have left, the military approach doesn't seem to have worked. Is there an approach that you think can work, or are we just going to have to live with this for quite a while?
Well, look, the military approach definitely will work, but the military approach will work when you use all the different other tools in the box.
Well, we blew up a big base in Afghanistan, but that doesn't seem to have changed anything.
Well, yeah, but blowing up the base and killing a leader of Al-Qaeda or ISIS is only half of the battle, right? Battling ISIS and defeating them in places like Raqqa and places like Mosul, this is the easy part, believe it or not. Battling these ideologies and defeating them in the hearts and minds of the disenfranchised and the alienated, this is a hard battle. And only when we start winning on that front, then we can win this war.
Ali Sufan's book, Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our
show.
Thank
you, sir. It's a great honor.